we present the Muse Quiz with your host, Sandy Toksvig.
Hello and welcome to the Muse Quiz. We start with a poster spotted in Maidstone Hospital, read by Harriet Cass.
Do you find it difficult to talk to hospital staff? There's a book that may help you. Please ask staff for a copy.
And our thanks to Sharon Brown for sending that in. Now let's meet the teams. Will you welcome first, on my right, Francis Ween and Bob Mills. And opposite them on my left, Jeremy Hardy and Andy Hamilton. Francis, who showed the courage and vision to sit through a 37-minute conference speech?
It's the Lib Dems at Brighton.
I just
fainted from overexcitement. Jolly exciting. The Telegraph website actually had a headline on it saying, Liberal Democrat Conference 2012, Day 3, As It Happened. It was that level of intensity. It was wonderful. We had Nick Clegg giving his thrilling speech where he brought them to a pitch of ecstasy by saying, we have the most ambitious home insulation policy ever seen in the UK. And also he said, we live in a period of change, as if this was some dramatic revelation. I mean, any party leader in history of conferences saying, we live in a time where nothing much is happening, so you might want to go home. But it's full of that stuff. We must go forwards, not backwards. Mm. Look to the future.
He made a fatal mistake with me because he said at one point, he said, if you want to vote for a stop the world, I want to get off party. And I thought, that's exactly the kind of party I want to vote.
Which was quite sweet because lots of the Lib Dem speakers asked the audience to imagine what life would have been like if the Conservatives have had a full majority. And I thought, well, it's surprisingly easy, as it turns out.
It's a bit confusing, their line on the coalition, though, isn't it? Because they have to sort of demonstrate that they're independent but also loyal. So they keep saying, we are very loyal to this coalition and it's vital that we're in the coalition with the Conservatives, whom we support in coalition, because if we weren't there, these dangerous psychopaths would be running the country. Clegg said, if you're being attacked by Liam Fox on one side and Ed Balls on the other, you're probably in the right place. You think, it could be that. Or, Nick, it could be that the entire country is united in despising you.
I like that he talked about the riots, and he mentioned a shop which survived two world wars, countless recessions, but was recently burnt to the ground. And he thought, well, sounds like the last 100 years of the Liberal Party.
His first gambit was mentioning the Olympics. The other party leaders must have been so annoyed. He was straight at, you thought, the first one up is going to claim the Olympics. And you knew as soon as the Olympics was such a success, all the conference organisers were going to be trying to get Olympians. That will be the big breakthrough, is when someone can get athletes on the platforms. They're all ringing up the International Olympic Committee saying, look, I want two black ones, a woman and one of the Paralympians. They've got to be gold medalists, OK? And the Tories are saying, could we have rowers, please? Mainly rowers, actually. There's something of a CBeebies about him as well. He said, you can't vote blue to go green. The only way to make blue go green is to add yellow. We know a song about that, don't we, boys and girls?
I do like it when politicians give a speech when they've got some members of the audience behind them in shot, because in our house we have a bet to see who's going to nod off first. Yeah. And honestly, I wish I'd had an accumulator, because they were all gone by the 15-minute mark.
The one thing I did like about him is that he's saying, and there can be no argument against it, there's a universal thing that old people get bus passes and cold weather allowances. And what he's saying is the voice of reason, surely. What, all old people? What about really, really wealthy old people? Surely they don't need it. And yet the only two old people he can come up with are Alan Sugar and Peter Stringfellow. After a while, you can't stop thinking, well, leave Stringfellow alone. He might get cold in the winter. Why are you picking on him now?
Yeah, yeah.
Stringfellow's got to keep his place warm because everybody's naked in
there. Yeah, there is.
The great semantic argument, though, which you can't fault him on, is this. When he said, we no longer want to be the third party. We want to be one of three parties. Oh. Yeah. Which one, Nick? The third one.
Yes, indeed, it's part party conference season. Oh, it sounds like rabid season. We can shoot them. The Liberal Democrat conference in Brighton saw Nick Clegg tell party members that they have to show courage and stick with the coalition and not go chickening out by standing by their beliefs and promises. Clegg gave a speech lasting 37 minutes, which is moving him on from his hit single and working on something album length. So 2 points to Francis. Bob, who got the best royal story by hook or by crook?
Oh, this is Frank Gardner, who's the security correspondent.
He is, yes.
BBC security correspondent. The Queen said to him in a very private lunch they were having that she was worried about the situation with Abu Hamza. Like most people in this country, she didn't understand it. Because basically the Queen's just like my mum. She probably does say, why don't they just sing him out? Well, they can't do that. That's how I'm imagining the conversation went.
But, I mean, who did the royal family think they are? We're not allowed to know their opinions. We're not allowed to see their breasts.
Frank mentioned this and has been chay-high to the rafters because these things are supposed to be completely and utterly private. But he was on the Today Show. That's the BBC's flagship. What time is it on?
It's early.
Early.
Six till nine.
I don't listen. I'm either in bed or it's clashing with Cash in the Attic. One or the other. But I have listened to it, and I can imagine Frank's sitting there, and he's the security correspondent, and they said, what's the situation with Abu Hamza? And he said, same as it's been for the last 8 years. There's nothing more I can tell you. And he's thinking, I'm getting nothing out of this, because that's what these things are like, these programmes. They're just egomaniacs desperately trying to get their bit in. It's like Mock the Week with travel news. And Frank's obviously thought, just as they've said to him, nothing else, Frank? And he's thought, did I mention that I'd spoken to the Queen about it? Yes, I was chatting with the Queen at one of our regular lunches that we're not going to be having anymore.
But actually, they've got power, haven't they? Because it's coming out that there is a thing called the royal veto and that they, behind the scenes, lots of things have to be run by... There's a constitutional thing that the Duchy of Cornwall, which is biscuits... basically, Prince Charles gets to oversee all manner of stuff and the Queen sits there...
It's to do with their land, isn't it?
Non-biscuit-related issues.
Non-biscuit-related. He's got a conflict of interest when it comes to biscuits. Therefore, he has to leave the room when biscuits are being discussed. But the Queen has, you know, she's obviously chipping and saying, well, this man should be banished to the colonies. Cut off his head. And saying, and like you say, it's a bit more complicated than that.
She's got so many fewer powers than she had, though. She
used to have X-ray vision, didn't she, at one time?
when you think back a couple of hundred years, when she sits there for her weekly audience with David Cameron and Cameron's giving it a load of blah, 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 I bet she's sitting there thinking, in the good old days, I could have had you burnt.
BBC correspondent Frank Gardner has apologised to the palace after revealing that the Queen had lobbied a former Home Secretary about the arrest of radical cleric Abu Hamza. Mr Hamza has rather distinctive looks and is easy to spot. First there is the hook for a hand, and then the fact that he is constantly followed by a crocodile with an alarm clock in his stomach. Because he's like a sort of, I don't know, like an identikit terrorist, isn't he, when you look at the pictures of him? The bit I don't understand, right, if you do lose your hand, why would you opt for a hook? Right? Why wouldn't you go for a false hand or something fun like sooty? I don't know why you... 2 points to Bob. Jeremy, who really hasn't heard the last of this?
This is very complicated. Whose side are you on? The police or Andrew Mitchell? It's a tricky one, really. Now, the government, of course, are saying, well, we have very great respect for the police because they do a difficult job. Now, when the government tells you you do a difficult job and they've got great respect for you, it can mean a number of things. It can mean you're about to be made redundant. It can mean they don't want to pay you very much because you work for the NHS. It can mean they're dismantling the service for which you work. It can mean you're a police officer. To be fair, the police haven't got a very good record on telling the truth. I mean, it used to be very easy to fake evidence, and that used to be very common. Usually, the police only lie, you know, basically they've made a mistake and they're trying to cover it up. They've, like, killed somebody or something like that. But this wasn't that kind of lie. If they'd said, he came at us like a man possessed with superhuman strength, we thought his bicycle was a surface-to-air missile. It wasn't that nature of lie. But the thing that makes you think it might not be true is the word pleb, because you kind of think, oh, nobody says pleb anymore unless they're singing Cry Me a River. And then I thought, well, actually, I think people probably do say pleb, because we're a much more snobbish country. You know, in the 80s and 90s, everyone said, oh, there's no class anymore, everyone's middle class. Because you've got people like Thatcher and Major and Heath, they were all from quite modest backgrounds. But now, I mean, this is the poshest government we've had. Now, I imagine they do sit around using pejorative class-based words like pleb and oik and younger son not in line to inherit the title.
It was a great snapshot, I thought, of how the class system still works in this country, because we have the ruling class and then we have the ruled class, which, you know, used to be called the working class. And it seems to me that the only weapon that the ruled class have has always been the art of the wind-up. And those police are on that gate all day long, right? They're bored stiff. They've probably encountered Mitchell before. They're probably thinking, oh, here comes the one with the short fuse. Good afternoon, Mr. Mitchell. How are you? Oh, I'm terribly sorry. No, you can't take your bike out of this particular gate because due to regulations, this gate is now reserved exclusively for the use of wizards and unicorns.
There was a poll in The Sun. I was going to say a newspaper, but stop myself. There's a poll in The Sun. 69% of readers believe Andrew Mitchell called the policeman a pleb. And I thought, is that how news works now? If we vote for a story, that makes it true.
Well, The Sun, I remember about 20 years ago, The Sun, when Princess Anne married Tim Lawrence, The Sun had a poll saying, is Princess Anne pregnant? And the majority of readers voted yes. And so they ran a story saying, Princess Anne is pregnant. And how right they were.
What must have happened to him, though? Because, as I understand it, what they asked him to do was dismount and go to a gate, which is about 20 seconds away, isn't it?
Yeah.
And he...
It's only just right next to
him. ..got in a real state. So what had happened to him? He'd come out at 10 Downing Street, and he found his wife in a threesome with George Osborne and Eric Pickles. What happened? Something tipped him over the edge that day.
Do you think he might be the missing Mitchell brother of Grant and Phil? I think, I mean, obviously he was adopted at birth by some rather posher family, but he's even angrier than them. I mean, and when policemen try to stop him cycling into Albert Square, he just says, shut it.
Do you
want some? Do you want some? Yeah? Eh?
Have it, have it. You don't run this government.
I'd watch that spin-off.
Yeah. I saw an MP being interviewed. I can't remember what it was. She's an MP for Islington, and she got the name wrong, and she kept saying, and David Mitchell has behaved very badly. And I just a wonderful image of this comic trying to get through the gates at number 10.
In his defence...
That Mitchell and pleb experience.
Conservative Chief Whip Andrew Mitchell is still denying he called a police officer a pleb for refusing to let him leave Downing Street by the main entrance. Before going into government, Mitchell worked for an investment bank. An investment bank is an institution which destroys the global economy and then gets bailed out by plebs. Do you know that Andrew Mitchell used to be a UN peacekeeper? It's no wonder the world's going to hell in a handcart. 2 points to Jeremy. Andy, next time you pop round to my place unexpectedly, you've got to ask yourself, do you feel lucky, punk? Well, that was
right.
Scary. That was really frightening.
You're right.
You know, for a brief moment, I really enjoyed that. That was horrible.
This is a judge in his sort of summing up in a case of burglary where the burglars had a misadventure, expressed the view that if you break into someone's house in the middle of the night, you should presume that they might possibly get a bit upset. And that maybe when you're performing your initial risk assessment, you should factor in the possibility that they might have a legally owned firearm and you might get shot. Now, actually, the law we have on this, I mean, the Mail and people keep campaigning for the law to be changed, but the law is actually quite clear and quite good, I think. What it says is that if someone breaks into your home, if you believe you are in danger, you have the right to defend yourself, and in certain circumstances, that can include using a firearm. What you don't have is the right to then crucify them on your front lawn. I don't know to what extent you're allowed to advertise that you are risky premises. Are you allowed to put beware of the gun? Are you allowed to have...
Sometimes you see a big picture of a dog and it says, I live here, and, and burglars think, oh, literate dogs, yeah. I'm out of here.
I think the rule is, I think what he was saying, what he actually said to Judge Pert, it's a lovely name.
It did sound like something from Carry On Burglars, didn't it?
is that if you go burglaring... Burglaring? Yeah, that's a word.
If you got pleb.
If someone breaks into your house, and they're young, fit men as these guys are, and they smash the door down, they're very much in the... If you then take out a gun, the balance of power is now completely shifted. Mm. So, in fact, you don't need to shoot them. What you should be doing is saying, right, put these on, because we're going to have a little bit of fun now.
We'd make them dress up in ladies' pants. That's a better punishment, isn't it, really? Because, you know, gunshot wounds you get over, but being made to dance around in a stranger's house in his partner's pants is probably something that would make you change your ways, I think.
Can I just say that I had a text message from Mr. Hardy this weekend. He was staying at my house and I wasn't there. He said, I'm at your house, I'm dressed as you.
Do you know what? The resemblance was frightening.
The judge, who sentenced two burglars to jail after they were shot while breaking into the rural cottage owned by Andy and Tracy Ferry, has warned burglars that it is a risk they must be prepared to take. The defending barrister described the burglars' wounds as a form of summary justice. Summary justice is just like wintry justice, but the judge wears yellow. The people who got burgled have since emigrated to Australia, apparently to avoid further contact with criminals. And I just thought, well... somebody who doesn't know their history. At the end of round one, the scores are Francis and Bob have got 4 points, but so too have Jeremy and Andy. We start round two with a notice from a hotel room in Malta.
If you would like to have a stool in the bathroom, please contact the reception desk.
And our thanks to David Lovell for sending us that. Francis, who is suffering from their complaints?
Oh, there's a report by the Patients Association saying doctors have turned nasty. Some GPs are operating a zero-tolerance policy because they've discovered that if patients complain, they are actually entitled to shoot them. I think as long as it's in the heat of the moment, you can do it. And patients are terrified of complaining about their GPs because basically the GPs just strike them off or give them a one-way ticket to the Dignitas clinic or something. You know, you don't want to get the wrong side of them because they have your life in their hands. I mean, I hasten to add, this does not apply to any of my doctors because I've been in and out of NHS treatment for the last 2 years and I don't want them to ban me and I don't want them to cut off my supplies of liquid morphine either. Actually, I did have a wonderful consult. Well, one of the many operations I had in the last couple of years, the night before, the surgeon came to see me in hospital and he said, right, well, tomorrow I'm going to take a disc or two out of your neck, but I have to come in from the front, so I'll cut open by your Adam's apple. And, of course, to get from the front through to the back where the discs are, I will have to go past, with my knife, your carotid artery, your jugular vein, your windpipe, things like that. So I just have to warn you, if I sneeze...
Do you know what, Francis? After all that, you still don't look like a woman.
They're saying that a lot of people find doctors rude and dismissive.
People are scared of doctors, yes.
Yeah. So some truth in that old joke. Doctor, doctor, I feel like a pair of curtains. Screw you, I'm playing golf.
My GP is very nice. I'd never see the same one. It's a practice, and you see three or four different ones, but they all seem to be very polite, and if you've got any problems, they sort it out with you, and I would never think of complaining. But I'll tell you this, that Obergruppenführer sitting in the front... They're the ones you want to be complaining about. If you can ever get to a doctor, past them. I went, my daughter said, I need to see a doctor. What's wrong with her? And you look at her like, you got a certificate, love? No. Your job, answer the phone. His job, doctor people.
I have to say, I've only ever had good treatment on. I did have a fantastically cheery nurse fairly recently for my cervical smear. And we were just mid-procedure, and she looked up and she went, can I just say how much I've always enjoyed your work? I said, you know, not now. Not really. A new report titled Patients and GPs, Partners in Care, claims that patients who have been badly treated by their GPs are too frightened to complain in case they are banned from their local surgery. Answering the charge as to whether GPs were dismissive, the head of the British Medical Association shrugged his shoulders and said, it's probably nothing. 2 points to Francis. Bob, have a listen to this. Bob, which patrician doesn't know his Latin?
Sorry, I delved in my bag then, because that's actually my ringtone. Oh, isn't it wonderful when you hear Thomas Arne's stirring piece? Our glorious leader was in America. He was sorting the UN out, telling them to pull their socks up about Syria. And they got him on David Letterman's show, which is their version of Jonathan Ross, only the guy's talented and it's funny. I thought he was very good. I thought he did a perfectly good job. But one of the things that Letterman did was, I'll ask you some questions. But he asked him who wrote Rule Britannia, and he took a stab in the dark. I think he said Elgar. Mm. But the next, you know, the press, he's made a twit of himself. He's made a fool of himself. Nobody knows who wrote Rule Britannia.
No.
And knowing who wrote it says a lot more about you than not knowing. To be quite honest, where he fell down slightly was they were talking about the Magna Carta, and they said, what's the literal translation of the Magna Carta? And he stumbled, and you think, well, come on. If it's Latin, take a guess on a rhyme, right? Carta, charter, maybe charter. And Magna, my kids, for instance, would know straight away that Magna's is great, because my son is drunk most nights. but he fell down on his Latin. But apart from that, thought he did a perfectly good job.
What were the other questions that he had?
He had to say where the Magna Carta was signed.
Yeah,
what,
knew that.
At the bottom.
Yeah. Oh, what do you mean? He answered. You're either right or you're wrong.
Yeah, but they also said, where's your arse and where's your elbow? And that left him completely.
No, but listen, if you'd have been an American, Mitt Romney or Obama, going on a show, you wouldn't have made any of the mistakes because you'd have had it all vetted and you'd have known in advance. So to say, yeah, I'll come on the show, chuck at me what you will and I'll take it as it comes.
But maybe he knew what Magna Carta meant, but he didn't want to admit knowing Latin because he'd lose the son's vote.
There you go, you see. That's what he's done. He's played it down. He's underplayed it.
Yeah.
he should have said...
But then the audience probably didn't know who he was either.
No, so that's true.
They thought he was the one in the next series of Downton Abbey.
The audience sat there thinking, David Cameron, why aren't you asking him about Titanic or Avatar? That's what you
were. I think you're right, Bobby. I think he's trying to play down being posh. He should have said, well, I wouldn't not know. I'm a good girl, I am.
David Cameron appeared on the David Letterman show and failed to answer questions about British history. Cameron said, you found me out. That is bad. I have ended my career on your show tonight. Sadly, he was only joking. He claimed he was on the show to boost Britain's image in the United States, which has been a bit shoddy since the Bullingdon Club smashed up New York during the summer holidays of 1982. 2 points to Bob. Jeremy, who's got 99 problems, child obesity being one?
A fat kid? I don't know.
99 problems.
Ice cream vans.
Oh yeah, okay. Ice cream vans are being discouraged from going onto some council estates because councils say they're contributing to childhood obesity. Nursing homes is where they should target, and seaside resorts. Old people like the Chimes, you hear Greensleeves, which was a big hit when old people were young.
But it was really about the decline in ice cream.
Well, they're being marginalised. They're being told you're making kids fat, go away.
They're being marginalised, and it's two things. It's not just the obesity. That's just ridiculous left-wing councils who should keep their fat noses out of other people's business. But also, parents... What used to happen, the ice cream man used to come, and you'd run out the door, and you go, and parents don't let their kids run out the door now. Mm. Hamlin, maybe they'd do that, but...
But if you want to combat child obesity, don't ban ice cream vans on council estates. Just make them go faster.
Yeah.
Yeah. After a Sunday dinner, you'd wait for the ice cream van to come round because you wouldn't have a pudding. In the summer, you'd wait. Mm. And you'd hear that chime and then you'd run out and you'd get rum and raisin, tutti frutti and Neapolitan. And it was all in black and white.
The number of ice cream vans left in Britain has decreased as concerns over health and safety, child obesity and van emissions have pushed them off the roads. There are now only 500 mobile ice cream vans left in the country, which, given the current rates of childhood obesity, is roughly one for every mobile child. The ice cream van industry started in the 1800s with horses, although pretty soon they switched to more conventional flavours. What with this and Andrew Mitchell, it's been a terrible week for Mr. Whippies, hasn't it? Now, before we reveal the final scores, let's hear the cuttings. The teams have brought along Mr. Ween.
Many thanks to John Rowbottom, who sent me this. It appeared on Wednesday this week, I think, on the BBC Travel website. Knutsford, Cheshire. Noah's Ark Lane closed because of flooding.
Mr. Mills.
This has come from South Africa, from Neil Clayton. Gauteng police have just announced the discovery of an arms cache of 200 semi-automatic rifles with 250,000 rounds of ammunition, 10 anti-tank missiles, 4 grenade launchers, 2 tons of heroin, and 25 trafficked prostitutes, all in a block of flats behind the Hillbrow Public Library. Local residents were stunned. A community spokesman said, "We're really shocked. We didn't even know we had a library."
Mr. Hardy.
This is from Ian Wright in Brisbane. It's from the New Zealand Herald, and it has a headline which is admirably blunt, I think. Hospital removes eel from man's bum. A man sought emergency treatment at hospital in Auckland this week with an eel stuck up his bottom. It is believed medics successfully removed it and the man was later discharged. According to the Department of Conservation, eels migrate upstream as elvers to find suitable adult habitat. They hunt by smell rather than sight.
Let's take a look at the final score. Francis and Bob have got 12 points, but this week's winners are Jeremy and Andy with 13. Before we leave you, here is an extract from an interview in the Metro sent in by Tom Bauer.
Sebastian Faulks, 59, is a constant surprise. Just when you think he's the last word in epic historical sagas, he delivers a 650-page novel on 19th-century advances in psychiatry. Then, after 2 weighty novels about the human mind, he tosses off a new James Bond.
And with that, goodbye.
Taking part in the news quiz were Francis Ween, Bob Mills, Jeremy Hardy and Andy Hamilton. On the chair was Sandy Toksvig and the news was read by me, Harriet Cass. The chair's script was written by Gareth Quinn, Roderick Crooks and Simon Littlefield, with additional material by Jack Bernhardt and Ola. The producer was Lindsay Fenner.